aquifer contamination, the earthquakes that are going on that had not occurred historically in that state, in that part of the state where fracking is occurring, and the state continues to do nothing about it in a regulatory way, then what is supposed to happen? I think it has to be a general policy.
I want to end with Congressmember Clark. You're from the same city not only Hillary Clinton represented, but Donald Trump is from, and his waffling on the Ku Klux Klan.
Well, it's unbelievable that in the 21st century that we'd have a presidential candidate that has to waffle on the issue of the Ku Klux Klan, of racial discrimination and bigotry. And it's really unfortunate that Donald Trump is using his residency, his candidacy.
We're going to have to leave it there. Yvette Clark, Raul Grijalva, thanks so much. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Holistic Tracking, Engaging All Our Senses, an experiential weekend workshop taking place March 11th through 13th at the Cedar Ridge Retreat in Vernonia, Oregon. Holistic Tracking calls upon all senses, including the inner senses, to become a conscious part of the dynamic story of life on Earth. The workshop teaches effective observation, reading local tracks and signs to follow a trail, building stronger connections with wildlife and nature, and more. Again, that's Holistic Tracking, Engaging All Our Senses, a weekend workshop taking place March 11th through 13th at the Cedar Ridge Retreat in Vernonia, Oregon. A link to register and more information can be found at KABU.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are not alone. Strike Debt Portland, in solidarity with the National Strike Debt Movement, will hold a debtors' assembly at 6805 North Macrum Street in St. John's on Saturday, March 12th, 3:30 to 5:30. Again, this Strike Debt Assembly is on Saturday, March 12th at 3:30 at 6805 North Macrum Street in St. John's, just off Willamette Boulevard. For more information, go to 350pdx.org.
The time is 5:01 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News. Follow KABU on Twitter and join in on conversations and up-to-the-minute updates on special programs. Just search for KBOO online or on your favorite Twitter app to find us. Learn about station news, find out about recommended events, and see what we're talking about, whether it be news, interviews, or music.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, protesters caught the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality by surprise last week.
It's Sunshine Week, and our KABU investigative reporter will share freedom of information websites for everyday people to find the dirt on the corporate sector.
And Portland City Commissioner Nick Fish voted no on the Right to Dream 2 move. Find out why.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Monday, March 7th, 2016. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Rosalind Scott. A Corvallis man accused of a hate crime against the Salman Al-Farisi Islamic Center is receiving probation after pleading guilty for trying to burn the building down. The building caught fire in November of 2010, within hours of news reports about the bomb threat against the Christmas tree lighting party at Pioneer Courthouse Square. While Mohammed Mahmoud did not actually set off a bomb at Pioneer Square, he received 30 years in prison. Federal prosecutors recommended that Cody Seth Crawford, who set the fire to the mosque in Corvallis, be sentenced to probation at the state hospital due to his mental health issues and the mosque leader's forgiveness.
The pastor who gave the invocation at Ted Cruz's local campaign appearance in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, was shot outside his church Saturday. Now the sheriff of Cowlitz County is sponsoring a public safety seminar featuring a showing of the film, Faith Under Fire. Run by the Sheepdog Safety Seminar Company, the event takes place Saturday, March 12th at the Longview First Baptist Church. Nationally, there's been an uptick in church shootings that has sent some congregations towards armed guards. In Longview this weekend, the featured speakers are world-renowned expert on violence, retired Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman, retired police officer and pastor Jimmy Meeks, and Carl Chin, a survivor of the violence at New Life Church in Colorado. The cost for Saturday is $99, and you can bring a guest.
Portland City Commissioner Dan Saltzman is proposing two new affordable housing resolutions for the Portland City Council to consider at this Wednesday's council meeting. One resolution would reduce the permitting time required for developing affordable or temporary housing in the city. The other resolution would waive reviews by the Design Commission and the Portland Historical Landmark Commission if developments include affordable housing units. Late last year, Portland declared an affordable housing emergency due to the rapid rise in housing and rental prices. Even with the rapid rise in rental and home prices, the Portland area still has one of the lowest vacancy rates in the nation, causing prices to continue to skyrocket. The two resolutions are separate from another. Earlier resolution proposed by Commissioner Dan Saltzman that would require all development projects with more than 20 units to make at least 20% of the units affordable housing. In the last year, Portland has approved $20 million in urban renewal funds dedicated to affordable housing. The City of Portland has also approved $20 million with $10 million of matching funds from Multnomah County to build overnight shelters and temporary housing in the city.
Gender disparities prevail in the 21st century, especially at the intersections of race, class, immigration status, and geography. On Wednesday evening, the Beaverton City Library hosts a free program to examine these disparities. Mind the Gaps, How Gender Shapes Our Lives, is a conversation with Jade Aguilar, an assistant professor of sociology and women's and gender studies at Willamette University. The event is sponsored by Oregon Humanities. This free program focuses on how to better understand the complexities of gender's effects on daily lives and identities. It also seeks to answer the question, what can disparities tell us about society's values and priorities? Aguilar will lead participants in conversation and examine ways of finding meaning within gender gaps. Mind the Gaps, How Gender Shapes Our Lives is scheduled for 6:30 p.m. Wednesday, March 16th at the Beaverton City Library located at 12375 Southwest 5th Street in Beaverton, and admission is free.
Multnomah County Commissioner Jules Bailey has picked up an endorsement in his bid to become Portland's next mayor. The Portland Police Association announced earlier today that they are endorsing Bailey. Bailey's campaign consultant, Stacy Dykus, has worked with the Police Association in the past, including doing communications consulting for the union for its Having Enough Police Lives Matter billboard campaign. In the last mayoral election in 2012, the PPA at first endorsed Jefferson Smith. They dropped that endorsement a month before the election, but they did not endorse Smith's opponent, Portland's current mayor, Charlie Hales. That was only the second time that the PPA had withdrawn its endorsement in the mayor's race. The first time was in 2004 when the union first endorsed, then later withdrew its endorsement of Jim Francesconi.
Some lucky Portland homeowners will get assistance paying for seismic retrofits for their home. The retrofits are part of a pilot project by the City of Portland and the nonprofit group Inhabit. A $500,000 FEMA grant is going to allow some 150 Southeast residents to seismically retrofit their homes, with the grant covering half the costs. Homeowners were chosen at random from a waiting list. Retrofits for those fortunate enough to benefit from the FEMA grants will have their retrofits completed during 2016. Homeowners who did not receive financial assistance from the grant could pay for retrofits themselves, which could cost upward of $20,000. Portland has more than 100,000 homes that need retrofitting to survive a major earthquake. City Commissioner Steve Novick, who oversees the Portland Bureau of Emergency Management, said that retrofitting 150 homes is only a start. Although all FEMA grants have been allocated, interested residents can find out more by visiting inhabit.org for updates about possible seismic incentives.
Heavy metal pollution from nearby factories in parts of East Portland has many residents concerned for their health. A group of neighborhood activists known as the Eastside Portland Air Coalition protested the Department of Environmental Quality last Thursday. KBOO reporter Jenna Yokoyama filed this report.
A crowd of protesters who live in the east side of Portland marched into the Department of Environmental Quality's office last Thursday to hand deliver a letter of demands to the DEQ's new interim director. At the heart of their protest is the recent disclosure of a dangerous amount of heavy metal pollutants being released by factories near their homes. I asked the protesters what worried them most.
The fact that we don't seem to have an adequate structure in place at the state level.
For 2+ years, I was eating essentially poisoned produce out of my garden.
What is my new cancer risk? What are my kids' new cancer risks?
My daughter has had a lot of respiratory problems since she was a baby. She's 15 now, and she's had pneumonia multiple times. She gets a lot of hacking coughs, and I can't help but wonder if it's from the air in Portland.
Yeah, since I moved to Portland, I can actually feel much more irritation in my lungs. I've never had problems with that in my whole life.
I grow a vegetable garden. I feed my children, my grandchildren.
What worries me most is that we have a toxic business culture that is happy to not pay the cost of their pollution and put that stuff all into our bodies.
If I'm in Portland, I'm breathing, I and my children and when I was pregnant and everybody around me are breathing toxic air.
What worries me most is that I have an 11-month-old daughter and she has only ever breathed toxic air.
Health concerns have driven some residents to get heavy metal testing. Of the residents I spoke with, some residents were able to get testing for their children, but not themselves.
My kids were tested. So far, we've gotten negative lead results back, but we're still waiting on arsenic and cadmium. My healthcare provider would not test my wife for me. Right now, their advice is just from the OHA is to test the kids. I'm not sure why.
To get some clarification on the Oregon Health Authority's recommendation regarding testing, I spoke with Jonathan Modi, a spokesperson for the OHA's Public Health Division.
We don't recommend the urine testing. Again, we're not discouraging it. We understand people are very concerned, and there is a mechanism for getting themselves tested. They should talk to the healthcare provider, but we certainly aren't, you know, at all saying that, you know, kids should get tested over adults or adults over kids at all. Anyone who is in the high-risk areas and they feel that they need to get tested should absolutely try to do that and talk to their doctor about the risks and what the options are.
He also addressed the issue of financial assistance for those who would like to get testing but lack insurance.
In the next week or two, we hope to have some, at least some sort of a mechanism in place for, getting those tests funded. We will hopefully announce that in the coming weeks. Don't have an exact date yet, but we will. Once that is known, we will surely get it out to the public as soon as possible.
Even if testing does become widely available to residents living near the centers of pollution, are these tests even necessary? To find out more, I spoke with Dr. Jillian Beecham, toxicology fellow at OHSU.
It is not absolutely necessary to get the test. So if someone feels like they're a bit worried about the situation, that the test is not affordable for them, if they don't get testing, I can't 100% say that they're doing fine. It's very unlikely that the test would have come back abnormal. And based on what we're seeing and based on the levels of the metals that we were seeing in the environment, it'd be highly unlikely for anyone to have an abnormal test. So if someone decides the test just isn't for them, it's just not financially feasible, there's a really good chance that they're going to do just fine.
So what came of the protesters' letter of demands? Well, not much. The Eastside Portland Air Coalition, the group that wrote the letter, says that the interim director seemed unwilling to address their demands. Whatever actions the DEQ takes next, Eastside residents are making sure their voices are heard. This group of protesters are encouraging others to get involved by reaching out to their elected officials. And if the DEQ doesn't start to make those badly needed changes, the new interim director may need to get used to the sound of outraged citizens.
It's our sign of
With the KBOO Evening News, I'm Jenny Yokoyama.
Get this settled! Our kids are dying of heavy metals! PDQ, get this settled!
Sunshine Week is an annual event celebrating the Freedom of Information Act. Many people believe freedom of information is for journalists, but by law, it's for everyone. Here to talk about tools for everyday people to find stuff out is KBOO's investigative reporter Robin Ryan. Within the past few months, Robin has filed stories on the water in Flint, Michigan, the Securities and Exchange Commission, Citizens United, and the Porter Ranch Methane Link. She's currently researching Advanced Publications Incorporated, the company that owns our Oregonian. Robin, thanks for being here with us.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, Robin, what makes you personally so relentless in digging through corporate databases?
I'm not sure we've got time for that much. Let's just say that.
We have a few minutes.
I'm really driven by the idea that stronger communities are more accurately and more thoroughly informed communities. And when I don't see the people who are paid to do that kind of work doing it in an effective way, it just kind of makes me get up in the morning and come here and do what I can to change that.
Okay. We'll just list some of the investigative resources you've turned up for us, and you go ahead and tell us what they're like, okay?
Okay.
Okay. Oh, first one.
ProPublica's Dollars for Docs database.
ProPublica has a lot of different kinds of transparency tools, including an NSA surveillance lawsuit tracker, but for the Sunshine Week exercises here at KBOO beginning Monday, I believe it's March 13th, ProPublica's Dollars for Docs page is where I think a good place to start is for healthcare interests. If Big Pharma has given your doctor a kickback or your healthcare entity, you know, if it's organizational, that information is going to be at ProPublica. All you have to do is go to the page, put in your state, and you're going to get back a list of what big pharma companies have paid what doctors. And I believe that total figure in this state is $24.6 million.
Okay. Open Secrets, Follow the Money, and Orstar.
I picked those for a Tuesday because most of the electoral activity between now and November's election is going to go on Tuesdays. And they do a variety of things, those three sites. Orstar is strictly limited to contributions and expenditures of campaigns for local candidates in Oregon. The National Institute for Money and State Politics, their website is called Follow the Money. And if you whoever contributed to the governor, whether they be individuals or non-individuals, I did a recent search of 800 records for the Fight for 15 and determined out of the top 50 donors for 16 state-level elected officials, 8.1% of those donors were actual human beings.
Oh, Robin, I've actually got a few more of these resources I'd like you to talk about. But first, can KBOO listeners find a list of some of these resources, some of the ones you mentioned and will be mentioning in the next few minutes, maybe on our website?
Yes, I'm hoping so, especially during Sunshine Week, because it's my hope to be able to do a presentation on each of the sites that we're discussing at that time.
Okay, a few more resources then. This one, Good Jobs First.
This is a project by the Corporate Research Project. And if you just want to learn about how to research corporations, there's lots of resources there. But my primary use of this particular tool is to track subsidies awarded to Fortune 500 companies at the state level, at the federal level. You'll find that a lot of the organizations that donate to federal candidates get a lot of this money.
It's a kind of a quid pro quo. You give a little bit of money to the candidate and they give it back to you in terms of these subsidies.
And then Open Secrets is probably the one that I am the most familiar with. I spend the most time there. It's pretty well known for being able to track contributions to candidates, but one of its newer features helps me extrapolate congressionally owned shares. I can determine how invested members of Congress are in the companies that get the sweet deals.
So that's actual members of Congress, their personal investments in these companies? They don't have to place their portfolio in some kind of blind trust when they serve in Congress, like the president does?
Some of them do and have. What I'm finding is a trend over the last 12 to 18 months or so is that there's, I guess I want to call it a firewall. They're putting their money in these hedge funds and investment houses, and they kind of take it from there. So most of the records that I can find right now are from 2014.
Well, it's an amazing what you're finding out. It seems like a very dark tunnel that you travel through to get all this information. And I would imagine certain sources would prefer it remained not quite out in the open like you've been doing. I've got a few more resources here. Next one is fedspending.org.
That's a site run by the Center for Effective Government, and there's a government-run site, just like it, called usaspending.gov, but the website was so full of inaccuracies that the Center for Effective Government started fedspending.org. You can also track stimulus funds. It's a color theme is green and white, and up in the upper left-hand corner, you can find contracts, loans, and stimulus money.
And one more resource here, Hack Oregon.
They're new, they're fresh, and they are right here in River City. Their premier program, it was called Behind the Curtain, and because I'm a girl who chases money in politics, that's what this does. And I was able to learn that a former Enron trader is the only person in the world who spent more money on Oregon politics in 2014 than Michael Bloomberg.
Oh, so the
through Hack Oregon.
And is this a site that cable listeners can contribute to if they have information? How would they go about that? Would they contact you in care of KABU, or go right to the site?
Go right to the site, because they do a whole lot more than just these websites. They're out there trying to show folks how to develop tools that I love to use.
And then I have one last question, and this one, I know it's a little bit premature, but you and I were talking earlier, and I know your current project is investigating ownership of our local paper, The Oregonian. Is there any kind of preview information you can give us? It may be in terms of what you're actually investigating right now.
Well, I can tell you what drove the curiosity. The Oregonian referred to Jules Bailey and Ted Wheeler's efforts to make themselves available to their voting public and to a wider field of candidates as a failure of their first leadership test. I don't believe that is media's role. Their job is to report, not to influence. And when you look at the vast array of publications and digital environments owned by the Newhouse brothers, there's not a lot of opportunity for competing opinions, facts, data to get through that big, huge, thick brick wall. I hope to try.
I look forward to that. It's important in terms of knowing when we're reading the daily newspaper, The Oregonian, maybe what some of the influences on The Oregonian are, but based on the interests of the owners. Robin, we've been talking with Robin Ryan, our KABU investigative reporter. Thanks very much for being here. And we want to, again, we gave a preview. You're very nice to do that. Look for Robin's work on our upcoming report all about The Oregonian, called Who Owns the O?
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with KBOO's own investigative reporter, Robin Ryan, about freedom of information and tools you can use to find out what's happening in the community. This will be followed by Labor Radio at 6, featuring a discussion with Naomi Walker from the National Office of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees Union regarding the continued threat to labor unions in Oregon. Then at 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Host Adam Carpinelli interviews Blake Simons, who is a relative of Jalil Muntakim. Muntakim is a political prisoner and prisoner of war from the Black Liberation Movement. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, chance of showers before 10 p.m., patchy fog after 10 p.m., then a slight chance of rain after 4 a.m. Otherwise, mostly cloudy with a low around 41. Tomorrow, rain mainly after 10 a.m. with patchy fog before 10 a.m., high near 48. Today in history. In 1965, peaceful civil rights demonstrators marching from Selma, Alabama, are brutally attacked with billy clubs and tear gas by the police on the Edmund Pettus Bridge, an event now called Bloody Sunday. And in 2011, President Barack Obama approved the resumption of military trials at the U.S. prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, ending a two-year ban. The quote of the day is from Bishop V. Gene Robinson, who said, "Remember how social change happens. Each of us has a worldview that pretty much interprets the world for us, puts our personal and public experiences in some kind of rational and understandable order. That worldview works fairly well for a period of time. Then something happens that renders it insufficient. Something happens that can't be fit into life as we have known and interpreted it."
It's 5:26, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Help! We political wordsmiths are in urgent need of help from lexicologists. The Republican presidential primary has gone so far out, so beyond accepted boundaries of civic and civil behavior, that we've run out of nouns and adjectives to describe the extreme weirdness. Terms like bizarre, loopy, a circus, grotesque, burlesque, and freak show just don't do justice to what's going on, so we need lexicographers to provide new and more graphic words for us. From the days of John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, American politics has never been an endeavor for the delicate. It's closer to a demolition derby than a game of badminton. But still, the slurfest and hate-mongering of the campaigns being run by Trump, Rubio, Cruz, Daffy, Sleepy, Dopey, Curly, and Moe are extraordinarily excremental. Who could have thought that in 2016, a major party's contenders for the presidency, not the presidency of some Phi Kappa Bubba fraternity, but of the U.S. of A., would degenerate into wholesale racial and religious bigotry, cartoonish xenophobia, crude misogyny, tabloid conspiracy theories, mocking of the disabled, and schoolboy taunts about each other's sweating, wetting of their pants, and the size of their body parts? Worse than an embarrassment, their asinine antics are preying on people's legitimate anger about being knocked out of the middle class by today's power elites and being consigned to a future of poverty. To distract America's hard-hit majority from looking up at these moneyed elites, the GOP's candidates are telling us to look down at, quote, them, and to fear, hate, and denigrate everyone who's, quote, not like us. This is Jim Hightower saying, a politics that convinces people that their lives can be better by making other people's lives worse is a path leading straight down into the hell of an American fascism.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
Former First Lady Nancy Reagan passed away on Sunday. She was 94 years old. The cause of death was congestive heart failure. Reagan was probably most famous for her Just Say No to Drugs campaign, which shaped U.S. drug policy throughout the 80s and 90s. During her husband's 2-year term in office, Reagan frequently consulted an astrologer whose advice and opinions reportedly helped shape White House policy. In later years, Nancy Reagan became an advocate for stem cell research. She will be buried in California next to her late husband at the Ronald Reagan Memorial Library.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Teamsters 848 bus driver Yvette Holmes. Holmes has filed a federal civil rights lawsuit alleging that Antelope Valley Transit Authority illegally fired her based on physical disability, race, and gender. She was fired for refusing to operate what she says was a dangerous bus with fumes leaking into the passenger compartment. Holmes says other black women workers are also victims of discrimination at AVTA. In her U.S. District Court suit, Holmes seeks reinstatement to her AVTA job and a change to company due process policy. Holmes drives a Los Angeles Metro bus now, but that job forces her into a long commute and a 10-hour workday on top of it. She's grateful, she says, for the backing of Teamsters Local 848, and she says she wants her old job back.
Struggle is really hard for me. I own a house, my husband has cancer, and I'm driving all these miles, and I really love my job. And to the listeners, I want them to know that it's important to have a Teamster 848 stand by you, and that if they're helping me get through this. And so I just want AVTA to understand that I want my job back, and I want that clause that they have in their policy to be removed.
The lawsuit seeks to rescind AVTA's retaliatory removal of Holmes, implement due process procedures at AVTA, as well as compensatory damages against the company.
This is Mitch Lawrence with the Sports Minute for Workers Independent News. Well, LeBron James again took his talents to South Beach, and he's caused another firestorm. The first time came in 2010 when he left Cleveland to go play for Miami and the Heat. This time, the Cavaliers had a 3-day break in their schedule, so he decided he needed to go to Miami again. He hooked up with former teammate and good buddy Dwayne Wade, and their workouts were captured on social media, and it set off a predictable angry reaction in Northeast Ohio. Why? Because it certainly isn't a good visual for the leader of the Cavs to be seen back in Miami and hanging out with Wade. Cleveland fans have a right to be upset with LeBron James. He shouldn't be spending any days off with a competitor. Whether LeBron intended it or not, the visual also reminds people that he could be a free agent this summer. And as everyone knows, there's always a chance he could leave Cleveland a second time. LeBron said it's nobody's business where he spends his free time. And it certainly is the Cavs' business, but LeBron has a tremendous amount of influence with his team. He's pretty much the de facto general manager, in fact, so they're not always going to call him out when he needs to be reprimanded for doing something wrong. This all boils down to something very basic. If you've noticed, the sports news has been dominated for months by Golden State and Stephen Curry, not LeBron. So this was LeBron's way of getting back in the headlines, even if he did the wrong thing. This is Mitch Lawrence.
Brought to you by the IBEW, 750,000 men and women powering the way for an American comeback. Information on how to become an International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Power Professional is online at IBEW.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Last week, Apache tribal members celebrated the 1-year occupation of the Oak Flats area of Arizona, where they are fighting a proposed copper mine that would become the largest in North America. The site of the mine is considered sacred by local Native American tribes who have occupied the area for the last year in protest. The mine would create a 2-mile-wide open-pit crater, destroying wildlife habitat and polluting the local aquifer. It would be deemed off-limits to uses like hiking and camping. Critics argue that the mine would further poison the drinking water and aquifers in an area where large uranium mines left over from the Cold War are still leaching toxins into the drinking water. Local Native American tribes have protested the mine proposal, claiming the area was sacred. In response, the National Park Service has decided to consider placing the area on the National Register of Historical Places. The public comment period for the process to place the site on the Historical Register has been extended through this Friday. However, a spokesman for the mining company has stated that they still plan to develop the mine, even if the area receives the historical designation.
The U.S. Forest Service has rejected a proposed development project near the Grand Canyon, which would have created more than 2,000 new homes near the national park. The Stilo Corporation of Italy wanted to turn the small town of Tucson, Arizona, population 580, into a high-end resort town with up to 2,000 new homes and condos, along with large-scale retail and restaurant centers. The new development would have been located less than a mile from the rim of the Grand Canyon and less than 7 miles from the Grand Canyon Village. The National Park Service called the proposed development the biggest threat to the Grand Canyon in its nearly 100-year existence. The new development would have occurred in the Kaibab National Forest, but was rejected by the U.S. Forest Service after it determined the resort would threaten groundwater that feeds Grand Canyon creeks and springs. The Forest Service also declared the development did not meet agency requirements, was opposed by the local community, and would damage the environment of the Grand Canyon, a World Heritage Site.
The U.S. Supreme Court today ruled in favor of a gay woman's parental rights over 3 children she adopted with her estranged lesbian partner. The court reversed a decision by the Alabama Supreme Court that invalidated the adoption. The adoptive mother, identified only by the initials V.L., said she was overjoyed by the ruling. V.L. was formerly in a relationship with a woman who is the birth mother of the 3 children, a 13-year-old and an 11-year-old twins. V.L. formally adopted the children in 2007 in Georgia, and the birth mother agreed to the adoption at the time. In 2011, the couple, who were not married, split up and V.L. filed for joint custody in Alabama. Lower courts ruled in her favor, but these rulings were overturned by both the State Appeals Court and the Alabama Supreme Court. The Alabama Supreme Court, which is under Chief Justice Roy Moore, has a history of hostility to gay rights and claimed that a Georgia court did not have the jurisdiction to issue the adoption order. V.L.'s lawyer said that the Alabama ruling, quote, effectively stripped V.L. of parental rights over the children she had raised since they were born. In an unsigned opinion, the U.S. Supreme Court said that the Alabama court was required to recognize the woman's parental rights because they had been legally established by the court in Georgia. Under the U.S. Constitution, state courts are required to recognize judgments issued by courts in other states. None of the 8 justices dissented.
Thousands of people from across Honduras traveled to the western city of La Esperanza over the weekend to attend a wake and funeral services for Berta Cáceres. The internationally recognized indigenous and land rights activist was murdered early Thursday morning when armed gunmen stormed her home and shot her dead, wounding a house guest in the process. Mourners across the region and around the world marked her death, and organizations in Mexico are calling for the safe return of the crime's sole witness, also a recognized environmental campaigner who was wounded in the attack. Shannon Young with Free Speech Radio News has more from Oaxaca, Mexico.
The funeral of slain Honduran activist Berta Cáceres drew thousands of mourners to her hometown of La Esperanza over the weekend. Her wake became an impromptu candlelight protest calling for justice. Her funeral included a miles-long march from her mother's home to a hillside chapel to the cemetery, with a line of mourners stretched out as far as the eye could see. Olivia Zúñiga, one of Cáceres' daughters, told Honduran community broadcaster Radio Progreso she wants an immediate halt to the extractive projects her mother opposed and that she doubts the government's ability to carry out an impartial investigation into the murder.
I'm asking other countries to immediately suspend their financial backing of the Honduran government because it's a state sponsor of human rights violations. It won't guarantee the lives of human rights defenders, not even when they have precautionary measures granted by the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. I also demand the government of Honduras sign an agreement with the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights so that international investigators and human rights experts work on this case alongside the Special Prosecutor's Office, because we need some kind of guarantee of an impartial investigation.
Zúñiga says the investigation appears to be off to a bad start, with the country's top security chief claiming that Cáceres turned down police protection measures, something her family says is untrue. Officials have arrested 3 people thus far, 2 members of COPIN, the indigenous rights organization Cáceres co-founded, and a neighborhood security guard. And Mexican environmental and social justice organizations are raising red flags concerned about the safety of Gustavo Castro, a prominent Mexican anti-mining campaigner and sole witness to the crime. Castro was wounded in the attack that killed Cáceres, but faked death until the gunman left. After giving lengthy and repeated depositions to Honduran authorities, Sunday morning, Honduran immigration officials refused to let him board a plane bound for Mexico. According to a Monday press release from Otros Mundos Chiapas, an NGO Castro leads in Mexico, Honduran authorities took the activist from the Mexican embassy in Tegucigalpa back to the western city of La Esperanza. Honduran investigators say they need Castro to expand on his deposition, but colleagues say he is being treated as a detainee and is suffering psychological abuse after witnessing the murder of his friend. Domingo Lechon of Otros Mundos Chiapas has been able to talk to Castro since the attack and told Latin American radio network Radio Mundo Real how Castro described his treatment at the hands of Honduran police.
He's a victim, but they're treating him like a suspect. They didn't return his belongings, his luggage, to him. They kept him in the same blood-stained clothes for 3 days straight, transferring him around. They weren't letting him sleep. They hardly let him eat. He wasn't given medical treatment, despite his wounds, until much later. He noted that they were trying to wear him down, to weaken him psychologically. We think they're trying to get him to implicate someone from the organization, from Copain, so that they can open up a line of investigation that points away from the ones we think are key, like investigating the companies Berta was fighting against.
As of deadline, Castro remained in the so-called protective custody of Honduran authorities. The country's Secretariat of Foreign Affairs says the government is pursuing all lines of investigation to quickly solve the crime and is receiving international support to that end from the U.S. government. Sharon Young, FSRN, Oaxaca.
At least 150 people are reported dead after U.S. forces carried out an airstrike in Somalia yesterday. The Pentagon said that the attack targeted a training camp reportedly used by al-Shabaab, a group affiliated with al-Qaeda. The camp was located 120 miles north of the capital, Mogadishu. Drones as well as conventional aircrafts were used in the attack.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jenna Yokoyama, Jeff Henderson, Joanna Peterson, Don Zair, Rosalind Scott, Paul Rowland, and Ken Jones. The producer is Doug McVeigh. Our engineer is Mike Fotoklis. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kate Brown's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Rosalind Scott. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, it's International Women's Day with all women programmers all day. At 7, Amy Goodman hosts Democracy Now! At 8, we hear two programs from the Women's International News Gathering Service. A Greek parliamentarian tells international women journalists of the ravages of austerity on her country, and a resident of the Greek island of Kos talks about refugees coming to Greece. Also, Canada's obligations under the UN Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women are not being fully met. At 9, on Alternative Radio, professor and activist Kianga Yamata Taylor speaks on Black Lives Matter. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Ani Haynes speaks with Camille from the Sex Workers Outreach Project. At 11, on Stage and Studio, host D. May Roberts features two exhibits focusing on Asian exclusion laws. She speaks with Eliza Canty Jones of the Oregon Historical Society and with filmmaker Felicia Low, who will be in town to show her film Chinese Couplets. And playwright Julia Cho talks about her writing process and her play, The Language Archive. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, guest host Zoe Piliafas talks with Kimberly Shang and Neka Kofex about the new mural on the Black United Fund building celebrating Black women leaders throughout the ages. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a current member? You can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
Stay tuned now for an interview with City Commissioner Nick Fish explaining why he voted no on moving Right to Dream 2. Good night, Rosalind.
Good night, Ken. Good night, Mike.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
When the Portland City Council voted to allow Right to Dream 2 to relocate it in the inner southeast Portland industrial area last month, Commissioner Nick Fish was the only commissioner to vote no. KBOO's Lisa Loving spoke with the commissioner about why he did that and what's ahead.
Nick, when we were listening to the live stream of the hearing that the city commissioners had about Right to Dream 2, there were a few things that caught our attention. But then when that hearing came back a few days later for a vote, one of the things that we were watching that we thought was remarkable was that you objected to who was being put in charge of Right to Dream 2 and the move.
Correct.
So can you explain that? Who is being put in charge of it, and how is that supposed to work?
Well, I'm still not clear, Lisa. It looks like the mayor's office has hired a former employee of the Office of Management and Finance to come out of retirement to manage some aspects of the camping